From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Enron, its political connections, and the special treatment it received in Washington. We talk with journalist Robert Bryce, author of the new book Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. Bryce is an Austin-based reporter who has been writing about Enron's political activities since 1997. Longtime labor leader Anthony Mazzocchi died Saturday at the age of 76. We'll listen back to a 1995 interview with him. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Gleason and Bang Bang You're Dead, two made-for-TV movies airing this Sunday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Police in the Washington, D.C. area say they have conclusively linked a murder in Virginia to a series of sniper attacks that left six other people dead over the past week. The seventh and latest victim was a 53-year-old man who was killed with a single shot last night while filling his gas tank at a station in Manassas, Virginia. Charlie Dean, the police chief of Prince William County, said investigators matched some of the evidence with earlier attacks.
The result of the autopsy, ballistic evidence has linked these cases.
Witnesses reported seeing a white minivan leaving the scene of the latest shooting, but police say they may not be connected. President Bush is praising the vote by the House of Representatives authorizing the use of military force against Iraq should the president decide it's necessary. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president made a brief statement about an hour after the House voted to approve the resolution on Iraq. He said this action sends a clear message to the world and to the United Nations Security Council that the threat posed by Iraq must be confronted.
Today's vote also sends a clear message to the Iraqi regime. It must disarm and comply with all existing UN resolutions, or it will be forced to comply.
The president said he hasn't yet made up his mind whether to launch an attack on Iraq, but he did say, quote, the days of Iraq acting as an outlaw state are coming to an end. The Senate has not yet scheduled a vote on the issue, but passage looks likely there as well. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
On Capitol Hill, a senator is blocking approval of President Bush's nominee to head the Food and Drug Administration because of an unrelated fight over health insurance for pregnant women. NPR's Julie Rovner has more.
New Mexico Democrat Jeff Bingaman says he won't let the Senate vote to confirm Mark McClellan to the FDA job until Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson explains why he withdrew his backing for a bill Bingaman is pushing. Both the bill and a regulation issued by the department last month make it easier for states to provide pregnant women with prenatal care. But while the bill makes pregnant women eligible for the federally funded Children's Health Insurance Program, the regulation makes only the fetus eligible. Backers of the bill say that by covering only the fetus, the regulation does not cover care the woman might need, such as pain relief during childbirth. Thompson, who endorsed the bill when it was introduced, has now recanted. He said in a letter on Tuesday he thinks the regulation is, quote, more comprehensive. Julie Rovner, NPR News, the Capitol.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 248 points, or 3.4%, to close at 7,533 in heavy trading of about 2 billion shares. The Nasdaq gained 49 points, or 4.4%. It closed at 1163. This is NPR News. Leaders of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees have reached agreement on an independent commission to investigate the September 11th attacks. The plan calls for a 10-member commission with two co-chairs, one who'd be appointed by the president and the other to be named by the Democratic leader in the Senate. The commission would look into intelligence, immigration policy, commercial aviation, and other issues connected with the terrorist attacks. Senator Joseph Lieberman, the chairman of the Senate Governmental Affairs Committee, said the commission won't seek to lay blame for the attacks, but will try to find new ways to keep them from happening again. Mexico City has hired former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani to clean up the capital's crime-ridden streets. NPR's Jerry Haddon reports from Mexico City.
Giuliani will have 1 year to do for Mexico City what he helped do for New York: transform a crime-ridden metropolis into a safe, or at least safer, place to live. Giuliani is credited with reducing crime in New York by nearly two-thirds in the early 1990s. as a hired consultant in Mexico, New York's once tough-talking leader will face a daunting task. This is a city where cab drivers are known to kidnap their clients, where the upper classes venture out with hired guns to guide them. Giuliani's team will help Mexico weed out its notoriously corrupt police. The former mayor says his first job will be analyzing crime statistics and making sure everything is being reported. That's another tough goal. Some 9 out of 10 Mexicans don't report crimes, fearing the police and lacking faith in the courts. Jerry Haddon, NPR News, Mexico City.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The broad-based S&P 500 gained 27 points, or 3.5%. It closed at 803. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, providing innovative approaches to food and facilities management services throughout North America. On the web at SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Enron collapse is the most egregious example of executive piracy in American corporate history, writes my guest Robert Bryce. Bryce is the author of the new book Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. He says Enron's failure wasn't just due to faulty accounting or poor regulation. It failed because key leaders at Enron lost their moral, ethical direction at the same time that the company was making multi-billion-dollar bets on fatally flawed projects. In tracing Enron's rise and fall, Bryce examines not only its financial dealings, but its political connections. He has covered Enron's political activities since 1997. Bryce is a former reporter for the Austin Chronicle and has written for the Texas Observer as well as other newspapers and magazines. I asked Bryce what makes the Enron story different from the other corporate scandals.
Well, Enron is different in that it's despite WorldCom and Tyco and Adelphia, Enron is still the biggest and the baddest of those scandals. At Enron, there was very deep and very hard to understand accounting fraud. There was executive looting. There was the corruption of the investment bankers on Wall Street. There was excessive use of stock options. There was excessive use of derivatives. There was complete corruption of the investment banks that worked with Enron. All of those things make this scandal, I believe, worse in many ways and also more corrosive to the attitude of investors than any of those other ones.
You write about every aspect of the Enron scandal. One of the areas that you write about is the politics of Enron, how Enron was very well politically connected, how it got that well connected, and what it got in return for being that well connected. So let's take a look a little bit at the political picture with
Sure.
Enron. Why is it important for a company like Enron to have friends in Washington?
Well, let me give you a little background first, and then I'll answer your question more directly. Houston oil companies have always been, and Houston energy companies have always been interested in maintaining good ties with Washington because so many different parts of their businesses are regulated. And then also they're also looking for help from Washington when they go overseas to open new markets and to explore for oil and gas in Africa or in Asia or wherever. What was important for Enron in terms of developing and really gaining friends in Washington was that they were continually, particularly in the 4 to 5 years before they went bankrupt, on the edge of new markets. They were developing new ways of trading oil and gas. They were developing new ways of creating new derivatives exchanges. And they had to make sure that as they went into each new market, as they went into each new state for the deregulation of electricity or to sell deregulated natural gas, they had to make sure that the politicians in those jurisdictions were not going to impede them.
Before we look at the Enron connections to the Bush family, let's start with the Clinton administration. What did Enron do for President Clinton?
Well, they were a big contributor to the Democratic National Committee. The Clinton administration included Enron executives on a number of the trips that Commerce Secretary Ron Brown took abroad. But the most important thing that the Clinton administration did for Enron was to provide political risk insurance and loan guarantees through the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. And this was critically important to Enron because during the years of the Clinton administration, Enron was moving overseas rapidly in a number of different regions, into India, into the United Kingdom, into Africa, to build new power plants, to build new trading operations. And they needed the backing backing of the Overseas Private Investment Corporation to make sure that they could get financing from other from banks.
No, the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, or OPIC, which is its acronym, is this is a group that's pretty unknown to most Americans. What does it do?
Well, in short, this is the smallest but perhaps most powerful investment bank in the world. The Overseas Private Investment Corporation was created during the Nixon administration to provide loan guarantees and political risk insurance to American corporations seeking to do business overseas. OPIC is backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. Treasury. So whatever loans that they extend, whatever political risk insurance they extend, is backed by taxpayers. Well, for instance, the best example of OPIC coming to help Enron was for Enron's Dabhol power project. It was a huge power plant that Enron built in India. It was the largest private investment ever made in India in the last 15 years. Biggest single project in the last two decades in India as well. Well, Enron would not have been able to make that investment, which ended up being over $2 billion. It had partners with General Electric and Bechtel, the big construction engineering firm, to build this power plant. But they would have never been able to do it without the backing of the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, which came up with loan guarantees and political risk insurance to back the commercial banks, who then took the risk on the project. But the Enron made certain that it courted the Clinton administration to make sure that they got the kind of treatment at OPIC that they wanted. And one former OPIC staffer told me, and I have it in the book, he said, whatever Enron wanted at OPIC, it got.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Bryce. He's an investigative reporter who's written a new book called Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. Let's talk about Enron's connections to George Bush Sr. and to George W. Bush. What were Enron's first contacts with George H.W. Bush?
Well, Ken Lay was an early contributor to George H.W. Bush when he made his first run for president against Ronald Reagan in 1980. Then later under the Reagan administration, Lay had a lot of contact with Bush in the effort to deregulate the natural gas markets, which was done under the Reagan administration. Then in 87, when Bush was running again for the White House, Lay was one of his first contributors. He gave him $1,000. He chaired fundraisers in Houston. Then when when Bush got to the White House, Lay was had a sleepover at the White House with George H.W. Bush. So then in 1990, Bush selected Lay to be a co-chairman of the host committee for the Economic Summit of Industrialized Nations in Houston. So that gave Lay a lot of access to Margaret Thatcher and to Gorbachev and other leaders who had come to Houston for that meeting. So that was really, over that decade, the Lay-Bush connection really developed. And then that led to, of course, greater cooperation and donations from Lay and Enron to George W. Bush.
And before we get to George W. Bush, in 1993, Enron hired former Secretary of State James Baker and former Secretary of Commerce Robert Mosbacher, and they were just out of the first Bush administration. What was their positions with Enron?
Kinley hired, at about that same time, he hired James A. Baker III, Robert Mosbacher, and about that same time, he hired Wendy Graham. But Baker and Mosbacher were hired by Enron to go to Kuwait and lobby the Kuwaitis on a power plant that Enron wanted to build in Kuwait. Now, this is right after the end of the Gulf War, and Kuwait had suffered enormous damage when the Iraqis invaded. And Enron was one of a number of companies that were really pushing the Kuwaitis to open up their markets and allow them to come in and open the power plant. Enron didn't get that contract for that power plant, but, I mean, if there's an example of Enron really clearly buying influence, that one's unsurpassed.
So the lobbying in Kuwait that Baker and Mosbacher did, would you say that's a very typical revolving door kind of position to have from government to private business? Or does this seem to you as being something out of the ordinary?
I think that example of James A. Baker III going to work for Enron, less than 3 months after he comes out of the State Department, is one of the most egregious abuses of the revolving door that I can recall. Here is a man who was the former Secretary of State who played a key role in the in the war in Kuwait, in planning strategy and dealing with the Kuwaitis and dealing with other Arab states. And now, you know, just as George H.W. Bush goes out of office, he turns around and sells himself as a lobbyist to a company that wants to profit essentially off of the war. And I think that I can recall no other example where a Secretary of State has been that blatant in terms of turning around and selling access.
Let's get to George W. Bush. Did Enron back George W. Bush in his campaign for governor of Texas?
Yes. George W. Bush was a great beneficiary of Enron's money, and all Enron executives donated $146,500 to George W. Bush's campaign, the executives and the company, whereas that was about seven times more than they contributed to Ann Richards, who was the Democratic opponent to George W. and the incumbent.
Are there things that Governor Bush did in Texas that directly benefited Enron?
Well, yes. He signed into law a bill deregulating the state's electricity markets. Now, that was something that had been working through the Texas legislature for some time. But Enron lobbyists made it clear to me, and I talk about it in the book, that as they were pushing for electricity deregulation, they knew that whatever happened, if they got stymied by the governor's staff and they weren't getting the kind of hearing that they wanted from the governor's staff, they knew they could always call back to Enron headquarters in Houston and ask Lay to call the governor, and they could immediately get through. That was a clear example of where Enron lobbyists and Enron personnel felt that they had extraordinary access to the governor that a lot of other corporations in the state clearly did not.
During the 1990s, Enron's political contributions kept rising. You say those contributions quadrupled between 1992 and 96, rising to over $1.1 million in 1996, with about 81% of that money going to Republicans. By the year 2000, the figure more than doubled again to $2.4 million, with 72% of that money going to Republicans. Were you in on any behind-the-scenes discussions at Enron about the value of giving an increasing amount of money to politicians?
No, not really. I think in some ways you could even say that this was simply that they were identified or they were aligned ideologically, that the Republicans were pushing a laissez-faire attitude, and that was clearly what Enron wanted. That was their whole business strategy was, leave us alone, let us go into these markets, let us open these markets and do what we will, and don't impede us.
What kind of contribution did Enron make to George W. Bush's presidential campaign?
Well, the company was a huge funder of the campaign throughout, and was Bush's biggest benefactor. I would argue that one of the key issues, though, that the company and Lay were able to make was during the Florida recount. Lay was a big contributor to the Bush campaign during the recount effort. But moreover, Enron supplied its airplanes to the Bush campaign during the Florida recount. And remember, this was in November of 2000. It was unclear who was going to prevail, whether it was going to be Al Gore or George W. Bush. And Enron provided its planes, as did, you know, three other Houston energy firms, Reliant Energy, Anadarko Petroleum, and Halliburton, all gave their planes to George W. Bush's campaign, which came at an absolutely critical time in order to allow the campaign to move its people from Houston to Washington to Florida to really manage their ability to and manage their whole campaign strategy.
Did the Democrats have companies that favored them supplying planes to them?
None. Al Gore didn't have any of this. Not only did George W. Bush during the recount out-fundraise him by about 4-1, Gore didn't have any enough contacts or good enough contacts in the business community to say, hey, I need an airplane to get my guys from Tennessee or from Washington to Florida. There, none of his campaign expense filings or contribution filings have shown any campaign plane donations similar to what Bush was able to get from the Houston energy firms.
My guest is Robert Bryce. He's written a new book called Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Bryce, author of a new book about the Enron scandal called Pipe Dreams. Bryce is a Texas-based journalist who has covered Enron's political activities since 1997. You say that Kenneth Lay recommended a total of 21 people for positions in the administration of George W. Bush. He only got 3 of the spots that he asked for, but that these were critically important jobs to Enron. What positions were they?
The positions that Enron and Ken Lay wanted filled were particularly important to them were to the FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And in fact, one of the key appointees that Lay was backing was Pat Wood, who Lay had also backed for the head of the Texas Public Utilities Commission right after Bush became governor in Texas. But Wood was believed in deregulation of energy markets. He was a strong proponent of Enron's position, generally speaking. And after Bush was elected, Lay wrote him and said, "We want Pat Wood as the head of the FERC." And indeed, that's what happened. Bush appointed Wood and made him head of the FERC. Another position that another person that was backed by Enron was Nora Brownell, who was also put on the FERC board. The third position was Glenn McCullough, who was appointed to the chairmanship of the Tennessee Valley Authority. This was just as important from Enron's point of view as the FERC appointments, because Enron had been involved in a long battle with the TVA over contracts that it had to supply electricity to the TVA, and it wanted a sympathetic ear there. And by getting McCullough in that spot, Enron gained a tactical advantage.
There were other people in the Bush administration who were connected to Enron. Do you want to list some of them?
Well, sure. Tom White, Secretary of the Army, is probably the one who has the deepest Enron ties, and also the ones that have been the cause of the most speculation and most investigation. He was in a key position at Enron Energy Services. He was the vice chairman there. Enron Energy Services was touted by Enron as the next big thing. This was going to be the company that was going to go in, retrofit buildings, save companies money on their energy bills, and make a ton of money in the process. Well, White made tens of millions of dollars in stock at Enron, and he, you know, has alleged that he wasn't involved in, did not have any knowledge of the accounting irregularities that were happening at Enron Energy Services. And really aggressive accounting that was happening at Enron Energy Services. And then he was appointed to this key position within the Pentagon, where he also recommended, once he got there, that the Pentagon begin looking at energy outsourcing of the type that Enron was offering.
Now, you're right that all of this gave Enron unprecedented access to the White House. Give us an example that you consider to be the most extreme example of the access that they had.
Well, I think that in terms of the Bush administration, that influence was shown in the National Energy Policy plan that the White House released last year. This was a document, and the whole process was headed by Vice President Dick Cheney. And Enron had numerous meetings with Cheney during the drafting of this document. Ken Lay investigations have shown that he's had something like a dozen phone calls either to Karl Rove or to Cheney himself. He had a personal meeting with Cheney. And there are aspects of that National Energy Plan that came out that were clearly written that favored Enron.
Now, Enron hired Wendy Graham about 5 weeks after her tenure on the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, after her position there ended. What was her work with Enron?
She served on Enron's board and made tens of thousands of dollars as a director every year. She also got stock options as an Enron director. What makes her position at Enron so important was that when she served at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, one of her last acts as chairman of that commission was to push through a proposal that exempted Enron's energy trading business from any federal oversight. That was critically important because when she got that job in early 93, Enron's gas trading business, known as the Gas Bank, was just starting to take off, and the company needed a free hand. It needed to be assured that federal regulators were not going to step in and prevent it from doing all the derivative swaps, all the futures contracts that it was just now beginning to get involved in. So Graham went from passing through that regulation at the CFTC to Enron's board in a span of about 5 weeks.
Now, Wendi Graham is also married to Senator Phil Graham, and his Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000 contained what's been described as the Enron exemption. What was the Enron exemption?
Well, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000 was critically important again to Enron because by 2000, the company's commodities futures and all of its derivatives business was enormous. The Commodity Futures Modernization Act took the regulation that Wendi Graham had passed through at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission in 93 and codified it and made it into law. And it went a step further. It said that whatever derivatives or whatever commodity futures are being traded on online exchanges like the one that Enron was operating were completely exempt from federal oversight and regulation, even if they were designed to be fraudulent. So here was Graham, who is married to an Enron board member, had a clear conflict of interest, was personally benefiting from money because his wife was being paid tens of thousands of dollars a year. I think she was paid over $100,000 in 2001 by Enron. Here was a regulation coming through the Senate that directly benefited Enron. And not only did Phil Graham not recuse himself from any involvement in that measure, he sponsored the bill.
Robert Bryce is the author of the new book Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of More Grandmothers Are Like Snowflakes, No Two Are Alike, a treasury of wit, wisdom, and heartwarming observations by Janet Lanise. From this and other NPR member stations, and Wiley, publishers of Turning Points, a new book series featuring Jackie Robinson and the Integration of Baseball by Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition, now at your local BookSense bookseller or wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Longtime labor leader Anthony Mazzocchi died on Saturday. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with him. Also, David Bianculli reviews two made-for-TV movies that will be shown Sunday, and we continue our conversation about the Enron scandal with investigative reporter Robert Bryce. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Bryce, author of the new book Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. Bryce is a Texas-based journalist who has covered Enron's political activities since 1997. The Enron investigation is continuing, and one of the aspects of it that has been in the news in the past few weeks is the charges against Andrew Fastow, who was the chief financial officer of Enron. And one of the things he's accused of is creating these, is fraudulent the right word? These fraudulent partnerships that was a way of cooking the books. I'm going to ask you to explain that. It's much too complicated for me to explain.
Sure. As Enron grew its business, particularly in the trading side, it was incurring greater costs, particularly as it set up the trading business. It needed more cash. It needed to raise more money throughout its businesses to fund the new ventures, which included Enron Broadband, Enron Online, Enron Energy Services. They were huge cash drains on the company's financials. But Enron couldn't afford to take on more debt. So the company created a number of off-balance sheet partnerships. Special purpose entities is the accounting term for them. And these SPEs, special purpose entities, then were used to essentially hide debt. And Fastow was the mastermind behind virtually all of these. Some of them involved selling power plants to an SPE that was connected directly with Fastow and was controlled by Fastow. So Fastow was, here he was as the Enron CFO. He was collecting a salary from Enron. He was collecting stock options from Enron. He was collecting a bonus from Enron based on the company's performance, which, of course, was exceedingly good because they didn't have to reflect all these outside debts. And further, he was making money from all of these off-balance sheet partnerships. So, you know, his total pay in from all of these deals probably in the last 2 to 3 years of Enron's existence was probably in the neighborhood of $70 to $80 million.
Let's look at another, you know, in quotes, innovation that Enron came up with that is one of the things that led to its downfall. I'm thinking of mark to market. I'm going to ask you to explain what it is and why this was innovative within Enron's field.
Sure. Well, I'll give you the 30-second accounting history before I get to mark to market.
Sure.
Accounting has a long history, and it began in the Renaissance in Italy, and with an idea that you book your profits all at one time, and you have a dual-sided ledger where you have your debits and your credits. This process or this method became known as the Italian method. Over the last five centuries, it became the worldwide standard for accounting, and it was known as accrual accounting or cost accounting. Well, in the last few decades, a new method has come to the fore, and it's used by a lot of trading companies, and it's called mark-to-market accounting. Now, it is not in any way an evil form of accounting. It's not fraudulent. It's used every day by mutual funds. At the end of every day, a mutual fund might hold 50 stocks, and at the end of the trading day, the owners of that mutual fund go through and they count all their stocks, they count the price, and then they divide that by the number of shares that they have, and they come up with the net asset value of that share of Janus or that share of Fidelity Magellan or whatever the mutual fund is. That's called marking their assets to market. They've used the market price that day and said, okay, well, here's what all of our shares in GE and Target and General Motors are all worth today. Okay. Well, Enron took mark to market and used it in its trading business to say, we have these long trading positions in natural gas or these long trading positions in electricity, and here is what we believe they are worth. But what Enron was able to do was abuse that process because for many of the commodities that they were trading, they might have a gas contract that goes out 20 years. Well, the New York Mercantile Exchange doesn't post prices for gas in 2022. It might post gas prices what they believe they'll be in 2006. So Enron was able to use those huge, long-dated contracts and say, well, we think gas, instead of being at $3, which is about the price today, we think it'll be trading for $9. Therefore, we believe this contract will be worth $100 or $200 million. They were essentially given a great deal of leeway in which to say, this contract is worth whatever we think it is. And they did that very aggressively, and they did that throughout their business. So That was why Enron was able to show extraordinary revenue growth, extraordinary profit growth from 1997 through 2001 when they went bankrupt, because they were able to use this very elastic kind of pricing mechanism to say, oh, our assets, our contracts that we hold are worth this much. In other words, if it was a 10-year contract to supply electricity to, say, Walmart, they would sign that contract and take all that revenue into the current quarter reporting period. And so they would have to yet then the following quarter, they'd have to find another contract and yet another to find new revenue to bill that or to claim that quarter.
Some of this is so complicated. I'm wondering what your mood is, having been through this elaborate research and investigation into Enron's politics and finances, bookkeeping and so on, and watching the way they manipulated the world around them. Not to mention all the money that they lost for their employees and stockholders. What kind of mood do you emerge from this with?
Well, I mean, at times it's really is depressing, because I interviewed so many people who'd lost their entire life savings. I write about Sherry Saunders, who is a very elegant woman who's now working at the Houston Medical Center, who I encountered at Enron Field shortly after the company went bankrupt. They had a job fair at Enron Field, which is now called Minute Maid Park. It's the Houston Astros baseball team stadium. And she'd lost all of her pension. She'd lost her job. She and her husband were really living hand to mouth, and she's found another job now. But, you know, it was people like her that really, you know, it was really heartbreaking to see their predicaments, that not only did they lose their job, they lost their savings. And while I think that, you know, I'm depressed about certain parts of the story, I also yet feel that that Enron was not emblematic necessarily of American business, that this is the biggest, it's the worst, and it's the most offensive, but I think that they were still an aberration, that they were so corrupted from the top down, whether it was in the accounting that they used, or their marital infidelities, or what they told the SEC, or how they corrupted the investment bankers. I don't think that that's the kind of practice that is commonly happens in American business. I still think that, and still have faith in the system, that it really does work. And I think that if regulators do what they're supposed to do now, if Congress does what they're supposed to do, it will give investors more confidence in the system. But it's going to take a lot more people like Andy Fastow in handcuffs to bring those people back. And I think that and investors even like me that are, you know, have been disillusioned. I think, you know, if there's enough prosecutions and enough of a really serious effort to reform the system, then I think everything will be okay.
Well, now that Enron, you know, has been exposed and it has gone bust, what after effects do you see of that in Texas?
Oh, in Houston's Energy Alley, it's been catastrophic. There have been thousands of layoffs. Companies like El Paso, a year ago was trading at $50. Now it's barely above $5, and there's a very serious threat that it will go bankrupt. Dynegy is on the verge of bankruptcy. Has been on the verge of bankruptcy for a long time. Williams Companies in Tulsa, another company that may very well go bankrupt, and its stock is trading under $2. And then we're not even getting to the other smaller companies that did business with Enron that are owed money by Enron that will never be paid. And those losses are in the hundreds of millions of dollars. In addition to, you know, all the suppliers, the flour companies, the limousine companies, all these other ones that are Enron's creditors.
Enron was very helpful to the administration of George W. Bush. George W. Bush and people in his administration were very helpful to Enron. Now that ties to Enron are perceived as damaging and embarrassing, has Bush and other members of the administration cut their ties to Kenneth Lay?
Oh, yes. Yeah, no. Ken Lay's become an untouchable for Bush. And in fact, I'd argue that, you know, the best thing Bush could do for himself is to do everything he can to make sure that Ken Lay ends up in handcuffs, if only to show that those donations, all the contributions, all the contacts that they had don't matter. And that, you know, were I the president, I would say, gosh, you know, we need to make sure and get, you know, and get the investigators on him double quick, because that would show that Bush is not showing any favorites in the investigation or prosecution of Enron.
You say in your book that you think the culture of Enron is responsible for a lot of the things that they did wrong and that went wrong there. What was with the culture of Enron?
Well, that is the, I think that that is the nut of the story, that yes, Enron had corrupt books. Yes, it had all this off balance sheet debt. It had this aggressive behavior, but all of those were part of a culture that was actually encouraged inside the company, that this idea that we're better, we're faster, we're smarter, we're more aggressive, and we're better looking than anybody else, and that that culture was ultimately so corrosive that the company could not overcome it. And that's a problem that I put firmly at the feet of Ken Lay. Lay was a smart guy. He was a PhD economist, but ultimately he was not able to manage the company's vision of itself. He could not control the company's culture, could not act strongly enough to keep people in line and prevent them from becoming egotistical monsters, which in the end, that's what they became, because everybody was making so much money. There was this belief that it would never end. And that's the key part of the story, I think, that allowed the corruption of the books. It allowed the creation of these off balance sheet deals. And that blame has to go to Ken Lay.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Bryce is the author of the new book Pipe Dreams: Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. Coming up, we remember labor leader Anthony Mazzocchi. This is Fresh Air. Labor leader Anthony Mazzocchi died Saturday at the age of 76 of pancreatic cancer. From the mid-60s to the early 90s, he was a leader of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union. He was one of the first union leaders to work in alliance with the environmental movement and was one of the forces behind the passage of OSHA, the Occupational Health and Safety Act. It was Mazzocchi who convinced Karen Silkwood to talk with a New York Times reporter about her accusation that she and other workers were being exposed to radiation at a nuclear fuel rod processing plant in Oklahoma. She died in a car crash on the way to meet the reporter. Her story was dramatized in a movie starring Meryl Streep. Mazzocchi left the union in 1991, disillusioned with the Democratic Party, which he believed took organized labor for granted. He founded a new party, the Labor Party. He hoped the party would reinvigorate the labor movement. I spoke with Mazzocchi in 1995 when he was planning the founding convention.
We want to become a movement again. The only gains that people have made in this nation, working people, have been through movements, civil rights movement, the labor movement, the environmental movement. Legislation has only been a reaction to the existence of these movements. What this effort is all about is the recreation of a new movement and the rejuvenation of a culture that once existed, a working class culture in this country. So part of this task in creating a party, a class party, we make no bones about it, this is going to be a party of the working class. We'll break down the nonsense that we're the middle class, we're the working class.
You say you want a working class culture. I'm not sure what working class means anymore. There was a time when working class was understood to mean people who worked in factories, people who did manual labor. A lot of those factory jobs don't exist anymore. What does working class mean?
Well, that's an ill definition of working class. When I grew up, working class meant anyone who worked for a wage and wasn't a manager or a small business person. Whether you're a white-collar or a blue-collar person, it never was meant to just encompass blue-collar workers. An office clerical worker is a member of the working class. They work for someone. And that's a large group of people. In a culture that existed when I came into this workforce, you understood the value of organization, of unions. You supported unions. In those days, if you lived in a neighborhood, it was a working-class neighborhood, and you scabbed on a strike, you probably could not come back to that neighborhood. Scabs had to be imported. People understood the nature of their class, and they knew the nature of those who were benefiting at their expense. That's been muddied over recent years due to a whole host of circumstances.
I'm interested in how you first got involved in labor. Did your father work in a union or your mother?
Well, my father was a trade unionist, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. He was an immigrant, came here in 1900, deeply involved in many labor struggles, was pro-Roosevelt to his core, and learned about labor unions around a dinner table during the Depression. I myself became active in the labor movement when I left the Army at the end of World War II and went to work in the automobile industry and then ultimately in the chemical industry. And
what kind of work were you doing in the chemical industry?
Oh, just ordinary work of mixing large groups of chemicals one to another, not knowing what they were, and mixing them under directions of someone else, and did various jobs. But I became a union official 2 or 3 years into work, and basically worked full-time for the union ever since then.
So when you started working with chemicals, I believe that was in the cosmetics industry?
Yes, just bulk chemicals and making a product that looked harmless.
So when did you start thinking that the vats of chemicals you were working with might actually be harmful and you wanted to know more about them?
Well, I think basically that occurred in the very early 60s when I in the 50s, I thought most of the problems were in the radioactive industries because we represented nuclear workers in my own union. But then when I became legislative director for my union in Washington, I began to hear complaints from workers all over the country about particular substances in their workplace. And I saw this as a trend, and what I thought were only isolated instances of problems, I began to see it as a collective trend that no workplace was safe. No one really knew what they worked with, and no one actually measured the amount of toxics that were introduced into the workplace in any meaningful way. And there weren't any federal laws that addressed these problems, and the state laws were ridiculous to start with. So that began the agitation for a national law.
You were one of the key people behind the scenes who worked to pass OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, that was signed into effect by President Nixon in 1970. It set safety standards for workers and provided for plant inspections and for enforcement. What did you want out of that?
We wanted a workplace free of hazard, and the law provides that. Its fundamental tenet is the workplace shall be free of all hazard. And by the way, you've cited a clear example of why a movement is necessary rather than embracing the existing political parties. It was under Lyndon Johnson and the Democrats. We couldn't even get that law out of committee. We got it out of committee during the Nixon era and got it passed, not because Nixon was a friend of working people, but because people were in motion in movements, the environmental movement and a reinvigorated labor movement who came to life around this issue.
You know, there's so many different groups that have thought of a third party, but they've often thought of a third party that would unite a lot of different groups. You know, the Rainbow Coalition idea, for instance, where you take a lot of people who felt disenfranchised for one reason or another and you build a party around them or build a movement around them. You know, I think the National Organization for Women has considered this kind of thing, too. But why start a labor party as opposed to a party that would be have a broader definition?
Well, we think a labor party is the broadest definition. It's a class party. It incorporates all the people you're talking about. Look, the most integrated places in America are workplaces. Those are the most integrated places. Where do you find the most people of color? You find them working. You find them as members of unions. Some of the top leadership doesn't reflect that. But where the people are, that's where you see the average American are in workplaces. So we have our conceptualization is the broadest conceptualization, incorporating a hell of a lot of people. Now we have to define what our agenda is, and once it's defined, to work with others who support this particular movement. And we're not building it around an individual. We've looked at third-party efforts in this country, and most of them collapsed after an election. The person that they were supporting did not receive an appropriate amount of votes, they disappeared the very next day. We're going beyond that. We'll someday we may run people for elective office, but they will have to grow out of a movement. The movement will have to define who they are and who they're responsible to.
You have held office within the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, and you ran for president a couple of times, narrowly lost. Do you ever find yourself wishing that you had run for electoral office?
Well, I made that mistake one time in 1964. I had the nomination to run for Congress in Long Island, and I bowed out because the party felt that because of my position on nuclear weapons testing, I was opposed to it, thought I would hurt the party in Long Island, and I withdrew, and a substitute was introduced for me, Lester Wolf, actually, went on to be a congressperson. I'm glad I never chose that route. At one time, I thought I could do something there, but I realized that that would have been a comfortable, nonsensical life where I wouldn't have really been able to impact, had an impact. I think I've been able to do more in the position I've been in.
Labor leader Anthony Mazzocchi, recorded in 1995. He died Saturday at the age of 76 of pancreatic cancer. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews two made-for-TV movies, one about Jackie Gleason, the other about school violence. This is Fresh Air. This Sunday, two very different made-for-TV movies will be presented by two very different networks. One is a dramatic biography of the comedian Jackie Gleason, televised by CBS. The other is a drama about school violence, televised by the pay cable channel Showtime. TV critic David Bianculli has reviews of both and a few thoughts about what their differences suggest.
When TV was young, it was live drama that reached for important themes and provided some of the most memorable work. Stuff like Marty by Patty Chayefsky and Patterns and Requiem for a Heavyweight by Rod Serling. Then, when most TV production moved from New York to Hollywood and from live to tape, another era began. An era that, beginning in the mid-1970s, could be called the golden age of telemovies and miniseries. For about a decade, TV kept doing one ambitious drama after another, from Roots and Holocaust to Masada and the execution of Private Slovak. But somewhere along the way, miniseries got too expensive, and telemovies on TV became disposable. The good stuff, the thoughtful stories, the historical memoirs, the big-picture epics, began showing up on cable. Nowadays, when the Emmy nominations are announced for movies and miniseries, it's rare for a production from ABC, CBS, or NBC to even make the cut. Shows like HBO's Band of Brothers and The Gathering Storm have grabbed most of the acclaim and attention, and deservedly so. This Sunday, that disparity between television then and now is on display in two competing telemovies and underscored by their subject matter. Gleason, on CBS, is a rather mean-spirited biography of the star of the same network's The Honeymooners. Bang Bang, You're Dead, on Showtime, is a volatile examination of a hot-button issue, violence and shootings in American high schools. Gleason is most interesting and effective when its star, Brad Garrett, the tall brother from Everybody Loves Raymond, is shown bullying his cast and crew to realize his own comic vision. But some of the details aren't right. It's implied, for instance, that the Honeymooners series was performed live, but it never was. And though Garrett's performance is good, the script is a big disappointment. It may explain why some people resented Jackie Gleason, but it does a lousy job explaining why so many millions of people found him funny. Bang Bang, You're Dead, on the other hand, is all about explanations and motivations. William Mastro Simone wrote it as an expanded version of his own one-act play. And in essence, this drama gets back to the spirit and intensity of the works by TV's Golden Age playwrights. In a way, it's doing now what those live TV dramas did then. It's looking closely at people on the fringes, people who usually are ignored, and trying to show what makes them tick. In the case of Bang Bang, You're Dead, the central character, an angry high schooler played without any excess showiness by Ben Foster, is cast in a school play. He's playing the part of a kid who kills his parents and shoots some classmates, a role that a peek at the young actor's private video diary suggests is very close to home.
They get off on watching you fighting back the tears, getting a lump in your throat, blushing, wanting to cry. And they give you a name.
Trash can.
Pizza face.
Loser. Faggot.
Loser. Weirdo.
Spaz.
Retard.
You know, the name does something to you. It changes who you are. It alters your molecule.
And one day you wake up and you look in the mirror and you don't recognize you anymore because you believe them.
They win, you lose.
You want to cry, please leave me alone, but nobody's listening because nobody cares because you don't have a name anymore because they took it away. And then one day, they say that name and you hear something go snap.
I trust you!
You realize what you got to do. You got to take back your name.
Bang Bang, You're Dead on cable is a topical and in times haunting and powerful telemovie. Gleason on CBS is an exercise in nostalgia that only adds to the suspicion that for the major networks, when it comes to telemovies and miniseries, these aren't the good old days.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Aveda, maker of earth-sensitive hair, body, and lifestyle products, and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, singer Jimmy Scott. There's a new biography of him, and one of his early CDs has been reissued. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.